Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
So as we stand to begin the journey phase for Root and Branch, the party stands on the edge of a vast forest. The Azura Wood looms before you, fog emanating from its fringes. You can make out the sound of water bubbling somewhere, and the caw of an occasional raven reverberates through these labyrinthine passages. Other sounds and perhaps furtive movements dot the underbrush right on the edge of your senses, but the mist is too thick to determine what caused them. This wood is a place that is very much alive, full of mystery and perhaps peril, and somewhere within these leafy pathways, the Root and Branch monster awaits. So for those people who are unfamiliar with Mappamundi, the journey phase is played with cards. In the research phase that our party have been going through, I have been building a deck of cards based on things they have and haven't discovered. And the journey phase is played through these cards until they reach their target at the end of the deck that I have assembled. And so we begin our journey phase, as I said, on the edge of the Azura Woods. And the first card we have is the Forest Inverted. And for some context, cards can be placed rightwise, which is right way up. And the party will receive a chance for an opportunity, or they will be revealed inverted, which means they will have a challenge to overcome. If they overcome that challenge, they are then able to take the opportunity and gain whatever they might gain from that space. So, the Forest Inverted. Thorny brambles dot every corner of the wood's confines. As the chroniclers enter into the woods, what started off as a relatively open forest border begins to feel like it's closing in on you somewhat. What little sound there was coming from the bog on the edge of the forest, the omnipresent sound of rain, the gusts of wind, even they seem to start to die away as you walk further into the forest. And as you continue moving in, 100 metres, 200 metres, 250 metres, 220, 275, 300 metres, the forest feels like it has begun to close behind you, almost as if it's defending itself. You suddenly come to a point where you can no longer move further forward. Brambles have snagged your clothes, and all paths that once appeared to be in front of you appear to be closed. How do you propose to get around this forest seemingly defending itself?
Well, it's all a trick of the mind. I mean, this forest is defending itself by blocking us off. We must almost push through this obstacle, and as I see it, we must, figure out a way to get through these brambles and these thistles that are in front of us, am I right?
They're in front of you and all around you.
Uh-huh.
Can I use my resourcefulness to potentially pick up like an old log and place it over the top of the brambles to kind of push them down a bit so we can traverse across?
You certainly can, yeah. Has anyone else got any other skills or any interventions they would like to make while Matt is trying to... Push,
no,
you know,
I was pretty much about to do the same thing Matt was just beat me to, but I can help Matt, can't I? So between us,
assist.
We can get grab a bigger log and use that as a bridge.
That'd be most helpful, good sir.
Well, you are an elderly fellow, and your back has seen better days.
Not that old.
Older than me.
This is getting far too into real life.
Getting very meta.
To you.
What about our other two companions? Have you got any ideas as well?
Traversing dangerous terrain isn't exactly my specialty.
No, it seems to be mine. Is this forest keeping us, trying to keep us out, or trying to keep something in?
Oh, good question. question indeed.
Yes.
But it does not get us it does not get us over at the Brambles.
No.
In which case, I think we'll find the log.
So, in this case, then, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask for... I'm going to ask Flower, Jay, and Sam to make traversal checks, please.
No, why me?
Traversal,
yeah.
That's a D4. So I've got a D. That's a D6 for me. So. Yeah, because I'm specifically... Ooh. Oh, one. Yeah, that's in character. Yeah. I'm terrible.
I got a 2. Flower, what do you get?
I got a 4. I'm on a D6.
So, Flower, you are able to kind of, you know, hunkering down into your armor and you know, like, you know, you are protected and suited to push your way through things. So Flower starts to kind of physically fight their way through the brambles. In the meantime, you know, with the fixer's, you know, natural innate resourcefulness, Matt kind of scrounges around on the ground and finds a log to kind of push these brambles down as much as they can and try to kind of manages to almost like crawl their way through. Jay and Sam, on the other hand, are falling victim to the forest, almost seemingly desperately trying to keep them out. Brambles are scratching at their faces. Their clothes are being ripped and torn and snagged. You know, capes are being caught in bramble bushes that are almost willing you not to go in any further.
Ah, this damn bush is just dragging me down.
So, in this case, you haven't overcome the challenge, but two of you have succeeded in kind of coming through these brambles relatively unscathed. So while Jay and Sam are continuing to fight their way through, Matt, I would invite you to shape this bit of the forest. What is it, you know, what is this bit of the forest saying to you? What are you feeling while you're here? What does this forest look like to you?
Vastly overgrown woodlands, dark, the occasional hoot of an owl. Brambles surround a massive clearing before turning back again into further brambles. Trails lead off in all sorts of different directions from sort of woodland critters. Perhaps a small ephemeral pond sits, filled with water, with life buzzing around the outside. The overall sense of peace and potential seclusion surrounds the area, surrounded by bramble.
And Flower, how do you, like, with this being a more difficult kind of a success nonetheless, you're able to move your way through these brambles, but with the almost a slightly more antagonistic feeling, what is Flower's kind of take on their on this part of their journey?
Probably as I got my way through different from the log is basically he just tucked his arms in, basically just walked through this thing through a little hole in. But it's like with all the arm and stuff, it's a bit quieter and I'd say more overgrown. So there's only a little bits of light coming through, so he can't really hear that much. Only basically like more of the beating of his own heart in the armor, knowing that basically some of his friends hasn't been able to get through, so it'll be a bit more, but he's more calm at this sort of aspect because this is his bread and butter, so he's calm, but he's also worried for his friends, so he doesn't want to go too far, so he's basically going to stay where he is so he doesn't desert those he cares about.
Understood. Okay, so this section of the forest then, when you step through the brambles, or step over the brambles, as it were, you've managed to come into this moment of peace and tranquility that is distinctly at odds with the experience of half of your party, who you can vaguely hear kind of scrabbling through the brambles, you know, the air turning somewhat blue as you hear them swearing their way through the cuts and scrapes that are afflicting them. But you notice that the forest, it seems, or this entrance to the forest is a barrier that you have managed to overcome, and you've done it almost as part of the forest. The forest has seemingly almost read your intention and has allowed you to cross over the top of it. And as you turn to face Flower, and you see that your friend, someone you've trained with, someone who, you know, you've been out into the semi-wilds with multiple times, and you see them, the calmness of the place that you found in the woods is mirrored in your friend's demeanor as they try valiantly to ease the way for their friends as much as possible. And finally, the calm that relaxes you and lets you know that while the forest has tried to defend itself, it has not specifically tried to defend itself against you and your party. This is just the natural behavior of the forest. You then see your two companions who have struggled through finally break their way through with the, you know, with the guiding hand and Eye of Flower having tried to help them get through these brambles. They stumble out, roll around a little bit, and then come to see the quiet that's around you. Jay, do you want to add some shaping in here? How is it that this moment, like, how is it that this moment of quiet and contemplation, how does that sit with your experience of having almost to physically fight your way through these brambles?
I think Kathy started out like her nose almost in a little sketchbook, attempting to take vivid record of the forest behaviour in the curling bramble stalks. And because of this, she trips and falls again on the tangling, snagging thorns before finally face planting her way into the clearing. And going from that struggling for the thorns to the dead, well, not dead quiet, there is birdsong and such, but relative quiet and openness of a clearing. In sharp contrast to the peaceful quiet, this is unnerving for someone who is very much an observer from the sidelines, to be in essentially in the middle of an open space that is far too quiet and far, well, not secluded enough for her to feel safe. The monsters and creatures she observes are in open clearings and calm glades. She is hidden in the ferns, usually outside, so it's quite unnerving.
Understood. And Sam, can you almost zoom in onto this scene, something in this scene that catches, you know, as you emerge from these brambles, you've almost been going through eyes closed, just crawling through, thinking, right, just one more crawl. And suddenly the pools aren't there. What is the first thing that catches your eye when you emerge?
I'll start the scene a little bit before this. I'm just getting to the edge of this thicket of brambles. And just, oh, this damn cape, it tears, and I sort of fly out this, you know, forward roll into this clearing. And the first thing that probably is going to take my eye would be the tranquility pool, or the small pond, that is just on the edge of this clearing. I'd say that's the first thing that strikes my eye, apart from obviously the overhead denseness of the oak trees, and the mixing of horn beams and, I don't know, a few ashes in there as well for good measure. And just, you know, a general, you know, clearing in, you know, surrounded by brambles. But the mysteriousness and the almost tranquility of the water in front of me is what really draws me to the scene, draws my eye, as yes, that is what gets me.
Understood. So this scene of tranquility has, for what is tranquil for one person and mirrors the almost the inner emotional fortitude of another, is actually unsettling for Jay. It's, she is not experiencing this scene in maybe quite perhaps as welcoming a way as Matt and Flower are. Potentially because of the experience of having come through the brambles, but also a kind of general sense of solitude is both welcoming and threatening in equal measure in Jay's eyes. And that kind of apprehension is centered around this reflecting pool, this tranquility pool, as Sam called it, that centers the clearing and provides almost, there is life in it, but that life is indifferent to your presence. So as you begin to, as you kind of get yourselves back up and you kind of collect yourselves as a party, what appeared to be only an animal track before, one of the tracks that Matt saw as he entered and contemplated the space, actually appears to be more of a well-worn path. And heading out down this path, the forest starts to kind of open up a little bit more. In some places, it becomes a little bit sparse, and the trees take on a different kind of hue and a different kind of colour. Where they were once rich browns, you know, evidently fed by the abundant rainfall and the rich soil, these trees start to look kind of grey and white and ashy. And as you move through, suddenly you will realise that it's not the trees necessarily that have changed colour, but that the fog has been very, very slowly over the mile that you've been walking become incredibly dense in a way that you weren't really aware of until you paid attention. It's almost as if the quietude that the fog has brought around has dulled your senses. And so we come across the next card in the journey phase, which is the fog rightwise. So here you see suddenly out of the corner of your eye, you catch a bright red ribbon tied to one of these trees. And as you reach forward and Flower, you're the guardian, so it's likely that you're going to be leading the walk through the forest here. So as Flower, you reach out and grab one of these ribbons, and you remember that Bastion, the mayor of Gascar, had said to you, don't forget that we've put the ribbons up. If you follow the ribbons, this is the safe path through the forest.
Follow the ribbons.
So as you continue forward, you notice that these ribbons are all in bright shades of red and orange, and so are easy to spot. And other comforting markers can be seen from afar despite the thick mist. Some ribbons have also been knotted in a style commonly used by Barbecia trail explorers to denote upcoming changes in terrain, such as potential potholes or routes. Flower, as you're leading this through, what is it that Flower is feeling? What is it that Flower is experiencing with this part of the forest and the ribbons guiding your way through?
It's always better to get more information about where we're going than where we've been from past experiences, but also of if any of this has changed since these were put on here. Got to be aware to adapt and persevere if anything else goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how, Sam, with how difficult it was to get through the brambles, what is it that this part of the forest, does this part of the forest feel different? Are you kind of getting different emotions or vibes kind of emanating from it?
Well, yes, as you said, it's almost like a break in the monotony. We've just come from, I don't know, travelling through these very dense woodland with thickets of brambles, terrible to walk through. And all of a sudden it's just, you know, spaced out. We've got this pond in front of us. It's a bit like, you know, a breath of, I don't know, an island of calm in a sea of storm. It's the best way to put it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
and,
no, I understand.
And you touched upon there about the vibe. And yeah, it's almost like there's some sort of energy in the area that just, I don't know, differentiates it from the rest.
So you can feel this energy. It's interesting that you should pick up on this energy, and this is the diviner's art at work. As you were all continuing to move through the woods, there is an unusual energy that almost feels like a power hidden within the fog, and it looks to you as you look, you know, off the trail, hands still firmly on the ribbons and following Flower's footsteps through the woods. Shapes kind of appear and disappear in the forest around you. Jay, does Karen notice anything about what these shapes might, did she get a sense of what these shapes might be or what they might signify?
I think Kathy will be after knowing the old man.
Sorry, I said Karen, not Kathy. Yeah. I apologize.
She is a Karen, actually. She would love to speak to the forest manager, if at all possible. Cersei's just not acceptable. The brambles are far too wild. How dare you? So Kathy would, after the old man thing, with the notations from the villages of Divinert, would be looking for anything that sparks her knowledge, is like a folk signal, a symbol that comes up in a lot of traditional stories or artworks. It's anything that would be familiar in that tone, or if there happens to be glimpses of smaller animals, mice or rats or voles sprinting away from the disturbance of people walking through, or birds suddenly going quiet in the midst of their singing.
So to metagame somewhat, and obviously because you were all fresh Mappamundi players,
mm-hmm.
These questions are for you to tell, you know, these questions are for you to provide answers to. You engaging in shaping a Mappamundi is an act where the players are telling the narrator the story. So rather than in a lot of other games, I, as the narrator or the GM in other games, would tell you what those kind of folk signals and shapes would be.
Okay.
In this case, I'm asking kind of specifically, what is it that Kathy is seeing? This is Kathy's world and Kathy's experience of this
world.
What is it that she sees and she feels in the woods?
So I think Kathy sees some vague shapes reminiscent of old nature gods, of wardings off against evil, and perhaps flickers of even that braided helix pattern we saw earlier, but nothing definite and nothing consolidated. Additionally, oddly, for such odd times in the forest, with disappearances, with a hunter going through, the animals don't seem disturbed. They're used to people well enough in the village, most likely. And the smaller animals obviously don't like being around humans. They'll flinch away and scurry into the underbrush, but none of them seem afraid. There's no obvious hint of a predator stalking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. So, and then Matt, what is Sir Derek feeling here? Is this having come from the tranquility of the clearing that he discovered, you know, in the early part of the forest? What is it that this fog is? Is feeling like? Is it, you know, is it dulling his senses? Is it heightening his senses? Is it, you know, unsettling him or making him feel more secure?
It almost feels as if there is something old within this wood. Something this fog is not necessarily maybe hiding, but companion to, perhaps. One goes hand in hand. The old, mysterious creatures and the fog that goes with them. The energy merely being a residual of the other.
So this forest then is communicating with you almost in its indifference to your presence. Where you entered the forest and the forest began to defend itself, not specifically against you, but almost any kind of intrusion, now it seems to be trying to communicate with you all. In Flower's case, it's the human mark that has been left on the forest is communicating with him. And as a guardian, he feels secure in the knowledge of the land that other people are sharing with him. For Kathy, it's a case of the patterns that are emerging in the forest harken back to nature gods and lessons that have been learned. And Matt, you seem to be picking up on this idea of the old and the symbiotic, that these nature gods are perhaps aspects of the fog, or vice versa, that one cannot exist without the other. And while they're not hiding from you, they're also not necessarily inviting you to witness them. And as you carry on through, as the, you know, following this trail along for 2, maybe even 3 miles, suddenly the fog begins to lift and break, and you hear the sound of ripples on the water, and what appears before you is a vast, vast lake. And suddenly, as Flower steps forward and a foot kind of steps through the fog, and a splash happens as his foot hits the water, you come across the lake, and the lake card here is inverted. The lake that confronts you is enormous. It almost beggars belief that a lake this large can exist inside of a forest, and you can see trees all around it. It's difficult to see over to the other side of the lake, but what you can see is a log raft lying by the lake's banks. But the wood, it appears, has rotted, and the cords holding the logs together are frayed and taut. It's the forest around you've approached this lake on a path. The forest has thickened so densely on either side of you that it is clear that it would take days, if not a full week, to try and get around this lake, so that crossing it appears to be your only real option. But as I said, the lake is vast in front of you, and what appears to be your route across has seen better days. How do you propose that that the chroniclers are going to move across this body of water?
Well, I think the first thing is that Caffey's going to remember that someone mentioned, I think it was Philip the Elder, that this whole area near the lake was swampy. So Caffey's going to grab a big old stick and start poking in the ground in front of her so she doesn't get sucked in by mud and sludge.
Very sensible.
Is there a way we can maybe make a raft?
There is a log raft lying in front of you, but it's rotten. Its planks are rotted and its cords are frayed and torn.
Could I use deduction to see if it would hold our weight?
You absolutely can. Roll me a deduction check.
That's a d6. Oh, that's a 2.
So as you put your foot on it, the way that you determine whether this is going to hold your weight or not is to put your weight on it. As you put your foot on it, you punch straight through the center, which opens a kind of hole in it. The wood on the outer edges appears to be in better condition than the wood in the center, which you've just put your hole through, your foot through and caused a hole, rather than put your hole through, which is a weird thing to say.
Oh, bugger.
Yes, I bugger indeed, Derek. So, I mean, how are we going to fix this? Can we maybe get some more wood to, reinforce this? And then we can sail over the water?
I think given the nature of this somewhat sentient forest, dead wood might be the option, rather than trying to cut down something living.
Dead
wood will still hold our weight, and it still floats.
As long as it's not rotten, yes.
Something try, then.
Damage anything.
So can we fix the boats is what I'm asking.
Each of you can give me an exploration check. So this is going to be a group exploration check. So I'll add your results together.
Right. D4. Oh, that's 3.
We got a 4 out of 6.
I can't remember what mine is. It is a
4.
Lovely. So let's see. Yeah, it's a 3 for me.
So that's 2 threes and 2 fours there, right?
3 threes.
And 1 4.
Three threes and a four. So a total of 13. Okay, so as you decide, you collectively you make the decision that this raft needs to be, if not repaired, then it needs to be bolstered with other wood. So you set out back a little bit down the path, looking for, as the fog has somewhat lifted a bit, you notice that there is dead wood and detritus, kind of larger sticks and some logs about as well. There's even Mapamundi Institute chroniclers are sent out with standard things that they will normally require out in the wilds, and each of you is carrying a length of rope. So you are able to bind these logs and sticks and bits of wood to the raft, and as you push it out a little bit, you kind of walk into the water with it. As you push it out and try and put your weight on it, it does appear to float. So this will, with some paddling on your part, will at least, you will at least be able to propel it across the lake.
La 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 la.
I was gonna say, can we get a long stick to make like a gondola?
Absolutely, you can, yeah. So I mean, Jay already picked up a stick.
Brilliant. So what's that guy's name on the River Styx? I can't remember his name.
Oh, Charon.
Thank you, Charon. I could be Charon on the River Styx.
That would mean we'd all be dead, so I'd prefer no one.
Hey, this is your hallucination, my dear. If you believe I'm Karen, I'd be Karen.
Everyone's Karen.
You are Karen. No.
I would very much like to speak to the manager.
So I mean, that's your way at the moment. Please come back between 2 and 4, 6 p.m.
4, 6 p.m.? Okay, whatever. I don't question Carmen at this point.
Well, being resourceful, could I potentially help find a bit of dead wood even faster or so to just make sure it is a little bit more better?
Sorry, say that again. I didn't quite catch what you were after there.
That's fine. Well, as I said, being resourceful, is it not then therefore a little bit easier to find a little bit of more material to make this thing a little bit more secure before we do set off?
So, I mean, you found, you know, the thing is as secure as you're going to make it at this point, right. I think. What you could do as a resourceful, you know, as a resourceful thing is try to rig up some form of sail that would allow to help you, you know, because this, you know, this lake is very, very, very wide. So one assumes that it's going to become very deep as you reach the middle.
It's like Michigan.
Yeah, it could very well be Lake Michigan. Yeah.
So with steady hands and resourceful, could I then potentially do that sail idea?
Absolutely, you can. Yeah, absolutely. So Matt, you rig up us as you know, as Kathy is kind of poling the raft off the shore. You spend some time rigging your cape up and fixing it to the raft in a way where it's going to catch the wind, and then Kathy can begin to use the pole almost as a rudder rather than a tool of propulsion to steer the raft across. As you are traveling across the lake, you begin to. It seems as though hours have passed, and sunset is, you know, the sun is beginning to set across the eastern horizon to which you are heading, and you're all the water and the journey has lulled you, and your general tiredness and with the energy that you've expended traveling through the forest so far has begun to tire you out, and you know you're almost beginning to kind of doze off a little bit, and then suddenly, almost out of nowhere, as you seem to hit where the center of the lake is, a huge gust of wind begins to pick up and seems to be swirling and eddying around the boat and around the raft and pushing you forward. The sail, you know, the makeshift sail is fully extended into the wind, and you're being dragged forward. And suddenly, as the sail starts to kind of almost fray and tear, you realize that it's not just the wind that's pushing you, but almost that the lake is pulling you in. And as the sun glints off the water, you realize that the wind is whipping up a colossal whirlpool in the center of the lake. Can everyone give me, unless you feel you have a relevant skill to contribute, can everyone give me a traversal check, please?
Steady hands can't help with that.
Steady hands. How would you use steady hands in this situation?
By basically taking two very big handfuls of the logs and holding on for dear life, basically.
So steady hands is gonna. You're using your steady hands to try and steady yourself on the boat.
And by the look of it, Kathy as well.
Yeah, traversal isn't her best thing. She's just a nerd.
Literally. I've got a 6 there, and I've spotted this disturbance in the water, and yeah, it's disturbing me indeed.
I was going to say, lads, I do apologise for the wind, but the beans do take it out on me.
Derek, I told you, you should just, you know, stay away from the beans. They're just.
But I like beans.
Yes, they're good for your heart, but we know what happens as a result. We don't, you know. I think it's time we have a group decision here, a group vote.
On this episode, David Attenborough gets IBS.
What's that brown thing in the water there? Oh.
Come on, it's just a stick. A sticky stick.
Yeah, it's a stick.
Right, anyhow.
Anyhow, there's a disturbance.
The 5-year-old shenanigans.
A disturbance. I sense a disturbance in the water.
The force? Right, let's. So, Kathy's going to attempt and fail, I think, to keep the rudder straight.
Have you made a traversal check for me, Kathy?
Yeah, it's a 1.
A 1,
that's
okay.
Why I said
so,
fail.
Yeah,
I got 3.
A 3 and
I got 6.
A 6. Okay, yeah. So, Kathy, in an attempt to keep the rudder, you know, try and keep the boat on course, actually gets dragged into the water. Now, normally in this situation, it would be the guardian that risks themselves to try and save the person who's in kind of physical mortal danger. But actually, it's Sam having rolled a 6 on the traversal dice there. Well done. Who actually, just as Kathy, it looks like Kathy is almost all the way into the water, just about still in contact with the boat. And Sam is able to reach out and grab onto her collar, drag her back into the boat, averting disaster there as this whirlpool grabs hold of the boat and starts to spin it round and spin it round. And while you're all hanging on for dear life, eventually the wind dies down and the whirlpool kind of releases the boat, propelling it further across the water. But at this point, the raft is on its last legs. The old ropes that were holding the original rotten logs together have fully snapped at this point. And thankfully, the ropes that you guys tied onto it are holding together. Kathy, with your near brush with death here, can you give us some shaping for how this journey is how your position within this vast body of water is making your character feel?
So Kathy is very much the studious nerd type, of a freak, special interest, I guess, in urology. She isn't adverse to water, but didn't tend to relish the training missions back at the academy, so to speak, that involved, you know, really getting into the wilderness. She liked writing about it, she liked learning, but not so much the actual physical task of it. So nearly falling into the water, a bit more dire than it might have been for anyone with a bit more level head. But she's doing okay, doing alright. Very excited to be even meters upon meters closer to whatever this giant beast is.
Matt, with, you know, having gripped onto the boat for dear life, you were almost in a prime position to observe what the lake looked like while you were being whipped around this whirlpool. What is it that Sir Derek noticed about the physicality of the lake?
It seemed almost as if the lake was being propelled by something deep within. A dark shadow waved itself across the water, underneath the water, almost gripping onto our little log raft. Some sort of almost giant tentacle, perhaps.
And Flower, Guardians are, as we've said, naturally at home in the wilds, but your experience so far has been actually relatively hostile for someone that immerses themselves in the idea of the wilds as much as the reality of them. How is it that Flower is kind of coping with this experience so far? What is it, if you almost zoomed out of the experience so far, what has Flower's feeling about his first exposure to this thing that he's venerated for so long? How is that, if you could zoom out and provide us that kind of top-down view of it?
None of this seems natural. It feels like it's been interfered with. It should be much, from all the experience he's had and all the things he's learnt, this is not right. It shouldn't be acting like this. Someone or something has altered this area.
Got you. All right, I've got you. So this is then the chroniclers find themselves in a wood that feels wrong. It's where, while there have been moments of tranquility and there have been moments of introspection and actually even potentially some moments of beauty, the forest feels this living forest that the chroniclers to one extent or another have realized is a living, sentient, even conscious being, an ecosystem or an amalgamation of beings, a network of beings, seems wrong, that something has upset whatever balance may have been here before. Eventually you make it, you know, soaking wet, cold from the wind, you finally make it to the shore of the lake. as night has fully fallen, and here seems like a sensible place to make camp on the edge of the lake. So making camp, you rest, you recover, and fortify yourselves for the journey the next day. No one is particularly in the mood, given the experience, you know, the relatively near-death experience you've just had on the lake. No one seems particularly in the mood to be sharing campfire stories. And as each of you sleep, the image of the helical shell, the helical mound that you've seen in these drawings from Pierre's room and in Anais's notes come back into your mind. And Jay, you dream that you are moving in the night. You remember, you know, your dreams are almost they're informed by the story of the old man and the forest, and that it feels like you move. And when you wake up, you all wake up with a bit of a start. You know, the sun has broken across the lake from the eastern horizon, sorry. And you all awake with a start with the sound of birdsong. And this is something you haven't heard for a while. And as you pack up and begin to move through the woods, you carry on heading east into the rising sun. And the forest starts to feel less threatening. It starts to feel calmer, almost as if there's more than just your presence and more than just the presence of whatever it is that has upset and disturbed the forest. And suddenly you're walking through a canopy, like almost a tunnel of trees. The trees are almost, they're formed in an arch, and you're able to kind of see through, and where, you know, you can see light at the end of this tunnel. The light, the sky is almost blocked out above you. The trees are so thick in this arch. And suddenly you enter into a clearing, an idyllic, beautiful clearing. And this card that emerges here is the clearing rightwise. The openness of this clearing is a welcome break from the long trek across the confined terrain that has defined your morning so far. And it feels like you have stumbled upon the woods' best kept secrets. Now this clearing, as you walk into it, the clearing feels like an ideal crossroads for the creatures of the Azura Wood. It's a welcoming space. It's a warming space. The canopy of the trees have opened up, and the sun beams a beautiful ray of sunlight into the clearing. What is it that you would like to do while you are here?
Check for more ribbons, if there are any.
Give me an observation check.
Okay, that is a d4. And that's a 4.
That's a 4. So as you were looking around, you notice that the route that you've come in is only one of several pathways or tracks coming into this clearing. It does feel and look like a crossroads point. As you look around, you're not seeing any ribbons or any signs that people from Gascar have come this far, or at least mapped this far. But you do get the sense of that there has been travel here, that people have been here before you. What you do notice, though, is one of the trees on the northern edge of the clearing is a huge, old, gnarled oak tree. And up in it, you can hear buzzing, and you can see bees flying in and out of this tree.
Can I look and see if there's a sign of anything very big having passed through here? Because it's a clearing, so any footprints might stand up more than they would on the forest floor.
Yeah, absolutely. Give me an exploration check.
I'm not very good at that, but I'll try. 3. Good news.
So, it doesn't look like anything of a huge size has been through here, but you do notice kind of large claw marks on the tree with the bees in it, as if a bear has climbed the tree in search of honey.
Winnie, are you out there?
Pull the trigger, Piglet.
Oh, bother.
Oh, well, that shouldn't be too much of a worry. Bears don't actually care too much about people, from what I've read.
It depends on if they have cubs.
That is a very good point, actually.
Yeah.
It would explain why we haven't seen any deer yet. But it seems like we haven't found the tracks of either the hunter or what he was hunting.
This is most disappointing.
So yeah, very quickly, I mean, Philip, can you see any tracks? I mean, just wondering.
Yes. If this is the clearing that we're meant to be meeting in, there must be some sort of give. There must be tracks of at least someone who's been here before.
Okay. Should we follow the tracks and see where they lead?
Well, hold just a moment. What about something hidden? Maybe they hid supplies.
In a clearing? To me, I feel a clearing for a hunter is a good place to make the final kill. I think if we, maybe look around and maybe follow some tracks, we might find our hunter man.
Maybe these people before us may have not left tracks, but they might have. It's always good to hang your supplies.
Oh, hang your supplies, yeah.
Yeah, so the bears don't reach their supplies. Or else it would be torn to pieces by now.
Are you suggesting that we look inside the tree?
Maybe pick a tree that doesn't have bees on it.
Flower, give me an observation check, please.
Yes, make sure. I've got so many pages up. That's only a d4. Two.
Two. Okay, so as you're looking around, you can't see anything hung up in the trees. But correct me if I'm wrong, you do have the tracks in the mud skill,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so that is a sensible one to use to determine if people have been travelling through this place. So making use of that skill as you're observing, you're kind of passively... also looking for kind of signs on the ground as well, and you do notice three sets of footprints. One slightly seems to be, to your eye, with your tracks in the mud skill, to your eye, one are heavier booted, big travel boot footprints that are heavier on the ground, appear to have been there a few days before two other sets of footprints, both of which are much lighter on the ground and are moving alongside one another. So as you're looking around the clearing, it becomes obvious to you that actually people have been here, and people have been here recently. Can you give us some descriptions of what this area feels like from a kind of guardians and trackers perspective?
I'll think about.
If you can't, that's also totally.
I can't think about, because it's like. I think all you'd be thinking of is like, this shouldn't be this deep. And particularly that, like, the game hunter shouldn't be interfering with this level of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did they get over the lake?
The raft was on our side, meaning that something must have brought it back.
Precisely.
We didn't see any other boats. They might have gone round, actually. They're not much of a time crunch as we are. We're following them, after all. I'm more curious about the recency. Did you say that the two sets were fresher than the older ones, the booted ones?
Yes, it seems like the two... much fresher.
Then it seems like instead of the hunter dragging those two people away, the local witches have gone to try and hunt down the hunter. If they get in his way, they could be in trouble.
Unless the hunter is the hunted.
That is good, though, because it means we'll likely meet them before we meet him.
It is entirely possible that something took the boat back. Something that perhaps the two ladies of the village are perhaps in, I would say, control, but maybe cooperation.
That seems possible. I'd be wary of pointing any fingers. Monsters that can control minds are fairly rare. But I think we should probably try and find the girls. They seem like they're going to start a fight. Oh, actually, wait, do they lead in separate directions, Flower?
No, they are all leaving in the same direction. They're all leading out. Okay, they're all leading out the eastern route out of the clearing.
Well, then we definitely need to get going on that. Don't want them interfering with the monster before we can study it.
So, with the party, then, so it's clear that the missing people, or there are three missing people, and there are three sets of footprints leading east. One set is the pair of footprints are fresher than the solo pair, and so it does appear that you are on the trail of people who are on the trail of another target. So as you kind of take what as you're leaving the clearing, Sam, you kind of turn around and take a moment to soak in the feeling of the clearing and kind of quiet your mind. Diviners are adept at reading the traces and the patterns that are left in fate's tapestry in the places that they're in. So while the rest of your companions are kind of moving along this eastern track, which is beginning to move up an incline, you take a moment to kind of consider the history of this clearing and its significance in the forest. What is it that stands out at you?
As I said, I think this area of the forest, as we have slightly moved on from the prior clearing, this area stands out to me in just the sheer, how do I say, alive of the area. We said there was bird calls in the area. This area has almost been rejuvenated from the prior woodland and area we saw, where it was much more of a bedraggled estate, where there were lots of brambles. I feel that this area is almost a bit of a culmination of peace, but change at the same time. It almost makes me feel unsure.
So I think that's a beautiful description of what is evidently a very, very important part. You've seen signs of life here, both human and non-human, all persons, but not necessarily human persons.
You got that there. As I was saying, I was more associating to the vibe of the air, of how much more alive it was compared to the prior areas we were sort of traversing through.
And so this, in a way then, if we think about the experiences of the forest so far, that the old gods, the old nature gods that Kathy kind of felt were melting in and out of the fog, that this is almost like a site of pilgrimage for the life of the forest to come and rejuvenate itself in the face of these old nature gods who are almost looking down into the clearing and protecting it, and you seem to be getting that feeling out of it.
Yeah, I guess so. It's I'd say more the feeling of rejuvenation instead of divine. I would say.
Absolutely. Okay, 100%. So
there is no god here.
There is no god.
I would pay.
I wouldn't go that far, I say, Kathy. I say the energy of this area is humblesome.
God has forsaken this place.
So then, as Sam, as you rejoin the party, and you start to move along this eastern track, you start to notice that you are definitively climbing. What at first was a very shallow incline is beginning to draw you up almost above parts of the canopy. And as you look back over your, you all look back over your shoulder, you start to see above the trees, you see the lake, you see the fog laying heavy on the western side of the lake that you've come from. And if you really, really, really focus and really kind of try to pay attention, you think you can almost see the edges of the forest beginning to disappear over the horizon. And as you continue to climb, the terrain starts to become rocky. It's almost as if you're moving up a kind of escarpment. And as you, the path starts to kind of meander and weave in and out, and you start to lose sight of what's both behind you and in front of you. And suddenly, as you turn a corner, you are taken aback to see a woman in her late teens, hunched over the unmoving prone body of a much, much older woman. Now, the card that comes out of the deck here is an opportunity card, and that opportunity is Rightwise. And so you see the girl has her back to you, and her companion is appears to be from this distance unconscious on the floor, and you can hear the girl weeping and kind of busying herself as much as she can over her companion.
Dear child, are you perhaps Elodie?
So she hasn't heard you come round the corner, and she turns around in shock, almost as if, and kind of puts her body in the way of you and the woman, the old woman lying on the floor, and she says, who are you? How do you know my name?
The entire village is wondering where the hell you are, and they decided we should look for you on our way to actually deal with more important things.
Yes, we were sent out here to find you, and I'm guessing Anis there, as well as a potential Pierre.
Who we may or may not be about to murder. Yes. Depends if that woman's dead, to be frank.
So Elodie kind of, she's a little bit wary of Kathy with kind of how direct that that greeting, if you can call it that, was, the introduction was. But she seems more reassured. She's overwhelmed by the fact that other people are here and that she's no longer kind of on her own in this situation. And she says, she's struggling to find her words, and she's sobbing, and she's like, once she kind of begins to calm down a bit, as you approach and she begins to calm down a bit, still placing her body in between you and Anais, she says, please, anything you can do, like Anais, she took a rock to the head. She's hurt. She's unconscious. I've tried to make her comfortable. I dragged her down here from the precipice. If there's anything you can do to help, please help her.
As a fixer with steady hands, can I potentially perform first aid unless anyone else has first
aid? Could I assist using folk tradition to think of any folk medicine?
Oh, I also have Don't Eat That, so perhaps I can find useful...
Oh yeah, like you can find like poisons that are actually herbs? Medicines, and yeah. I can tell if they're good for folk medicine. Teamwork.
So, in this instance then, Jay and Matt, you both want to go, you kind of want to scarper back down to the clearing, for example, and have a look, one, see if you can think of any medicine. Herbal remedies in this place, and...
Check
and
first if she's alive.
Yeah, if she's dead.
Because if she's dead, then there's no point.
So she is. You can see that she's breathing. She's kind of. It's raspy breath, but she is definitively alive.
Right.
Oh, then, before we go, who hit her with the rock? We won't judge if it's you, but we do need to know.
She says it was the and she's struggling for words. She says the monster, we saw it.
On purpose or accident?
She said rocks were, she said that man, that awful man, jumped onto its back and the rocks were flying everywhere.
Okay, fine. Good. No one tried to Cain and Abel that bitch. We'll get this medicine.
Language, my dear, language. Perhaps we should take the elderly lady down to the clearing.
The clearing we know a bear's been in? I mean, if we want to feed the wildlife, that's a bad way to do it.
Well, we need to take them somewhere safer. We can't leave them here.
Honey is indeed a disinfectant.
Oh, you're not wrong.
Don't call me honey.
Call me sugar.
Philip, I think maybe if you could go into the tree and retrieve some honey for this elderly lady. Perhaps we could prevent an infection.
I do concur.
All right, so Flower, you go running back to the clearing and you get to the base of the tree. I need a traversal check, please.
Can you use me quick thinking?
You can use quick thinking. In this case, it will make the traversal check easier.
All right. Let me double check.
You can quick think all you want about climbing the tree, but you do still have to climb it.
Yeah.
Oh, there's wow. a tree five here. Out of six. How do I climb a tree?
What was that, a six?
5 out of 6.
Oh, you're out of 6, yeah.
5's not bad still.
Mm. All right, so you shin up the tree. You're kind of climbing up. But one of the things your quick thinking does allow you to do is to think just before you climb up, you gather some kind of dead leaves and moss from the bottom of the tree. And you using some string in your pack, you tie them around a stick and you get them smoking. You kind of use your flint and sparker in your pack and you get the wood. Oh. You get the leaves smoking a bit. So as you're climbing the tree, you're holding this up to the hive, and the smoke obviously calms the bees down. That allows you to reach into the hive, take some honey without disturbing the bees too much, and get back down the tree without being stung. So armed with your honey, you go running back up this hill and deliver your prize to your party.
Ah, well done. Although she has already died, so. I guess then we apply to the wound.
Yeah,
probably so, a head wound if she's passed out.
Yeah, so applying the honey to the head wound is you're right. Obviously, honey is naturally antiseptic. So this is gonna, you know, it's not gonna bring her back to consciousness. You know, she's taken a rock to the head, but it is gonna help you. It is going to help you kind of deal with any potential infection. So while Philip was away finding this honey, the rest of the party are obviously still with Elodie and Anais. Are there anything you want to kind of ask them? Well, ask her, because obviously Anais is unconscious.
Does anyone have any smelling salts?
No, but hang on.
How about you take off one of your socks? That would probably do the same thing.
I washed them 2 weeks ago. They're fine. Anise, was it? Oh no, your Elodie. I always forget. Why were you and your mentor, I think, going after that hunter?
So she's calmed down, knowing that you are here to help her. She's kind of calmed down. She's still on edge, obviously. She's still very concerned. She's kind of crouched back down by Anais and has got her head propped up a little bit and is trying to, clean off the dried blood and stuff like that. But she says, Anais, she is my mentor, or at least, I want her to be. She says Anais is a trained diviner. She trained at, in Moltieres at the Diviners College, and I'm desperate to go. My mother, before she died, my mother was,
a diviner.
Not quite, but she says she heard fate more than the rest of us did. And she says, I think I hear it. I hear fate too. And so I want to go and train. But Anais said, I needed more experience of the wilds. I needed to see fate in her rawest form, and to see a monster is to witness fate's will up close. And so when she says Anais has been researching for months. She thinks she thought that the change in the weather was because a monster had come to the area. And so we set out. We set out some days ago, and she said that once we came back, she would write my letter of recommendation. But maybe I wasn't ready, because look at what's happened. She's hurt. That man attacked the monster. Maybe I'm not. Maybe my father's right. Maybe I should just stay in the village.
My dear, We've all taken a rock to the head at one point or another.
And you can tell. But in any case, I would caution you. It seems you do need more experience. After all, while I'm no diviner myself, I can tell you that to know fate isn't to try and stop it, to stand in its way, or to think you can control it, but to watch it, observe it. Observation is much of what I do.
Her lip kind of starts to quiver, and you can tell that you've touched a nerve here with this. That, and she said we wanted to come out and to see it up close, and then we picked up the trail of that awful man, and then Anae said we had to do what we could to protect it, and that's when we saw him throw himself onto its back, and it started to churn itself about and throw rocks everywhere. And once Anais got hit, I didn't see what happened to the man, but I had to drag her out of there.
A good heart in both yourself and your mentor then, but one thing I'd caution you to remember is humans, we often forget. We're not separate from this world. We're not separate from fate. You can't control it. You can't master it. And it will take you on as much of a ride as it will any creature in these woods. You're no less a part of this world than anything else. But still, you seem kind-hearted and strong-willed enough to actually come out here and stick with your mentor rather than running, so I suppose you'll do quite well.
So she kind of smiles at that a bit. She's reassured.
Tell us where the hunter is. I fully intend to dig a grave for that man.
So she says, she kind of points in the direction further up, and she says, we were up there and we saw him on the other side of the crevasse, the other side of the dip, the depression. I don't know where he ended up. She's kind of frantically trying to get her thoughts in order, and she's like, he can't have stayed on top of it. The way that it was thrashing about, he can't have stayed on top of it. She says, I'd put any money, any number of bears you wanted, I'd put money that he's over that hill.
Good. And in regards to anything you happen to hear, scream, shouting, please for mercy. If you don't tell, I won't.
I am starting to get incredibly worried about you.
Oh, I'm fine. Don't worry.
I think it was the rock in the head, but did it?
More than likely.
I think she spent too much time in these woods.
As have we all.
Yes.
So, with this at this point, then I assume the party is ready to carry on their mission to try and track down the monster and discover what has happened to the hunter, right?
Yes.
Hello.
Okay. So, with the honey applied to Anais's wounds and hearing her kind of beginning to mumble a bit under her breath, you're as certain can be at this point that she's not in any immediate danger. So you leave what remains of your kind of traveling equipment next to Elodie and Anais, with the implied understanding that this means you will be coming back to help them out of the forest after you've met your quarry. And so with one glance back just to make sure they're all right, and with Elodie kind of giving you a kind of slightly worried smile, you trek up this steep incline, and as you come over the top, as you kind of reach the peak of this incline, you see a huge almost like a bowl made out of the rock down in front of you. It's difficult to see fully down into it from your current vantage point, but as you turn to your left, you see a tall man, easily 6'6", 6'7", built, muscled man, propped up against a rock with one arm limping, hanging limp at his side, and blood coming forth from a kind of a gash wound on his right arm. The card coming out of the deck here is another opportunity card, and that opportunity is Pierre Verger, the huntsman.
Do I see any like rocks perched precariously on a cliff edge, Wile E. Coyote style?
give me an observation check.
He's already injured. He might not be able to dodge. Five.
A five. You do not. But what you do see is that there are broken shards of what appear to be a spear littered around where Pierre is propped up against, you know, propped up against some rocks.
Oh, delightful. He's defenseless.
Cathy, hold, my dear. One moment. With don't eat that, can I find some mushrooms that are poisonous and potentially with the pretense of healing and, oh yes, we're here to help, feed him said mushrooms.
I will remind you that graduates of the Mappamundi Institute swear an oath to do no harm in the world.
Damn it.
God damn it. I had my fingers crossed, okay? After all, isn't taking a hunter who hunts endangered monsters out of the world a net good?
I mean, it could,
am I really doing harm?
It could be argued as such. It could, your definition of harm could, justice.
My point here is that this huntsman is trying to change the ecology of this wild area.
I like that Cappy's got everyone on the murder train so quick.
Not me.
I mean, I feel we need to, you know, dispose of this huntsman somehow. He must have retribution.
This is one of the issues when you make a no combat game. The players will find a way.
Well, I will add, I will metagame somewhat and say this is the 21st game I've run and you're the first people to desire to actually kill him.
I'm not.
People have found ways to exacerbate his injuries, but no one has explicitly
said so they went to torture but not murder the cowards.
Yeah, torture is maybe a strong word for what they did, but should we explore the current, I mean, so let's bring Pierre onto the scene, shall we? So as you turn and see him, he locks eyes with you and you get the sense that he knows exactly who you are and exactly where you've come from. And he spits onto the ground, and a decent amount of fresh blood comes out of his mouth as he spits. This is a man who is decked out in the tools of his trade. He is, he's wearing, you know, foresty colors, earthy tones. He is evidently attempted to camouflage himself in these woods. As I said, his left arm is hanging limply down by his side. And he's you know, kind of somewhat staunched to the bleeding from the wound on his right arm. And as you lock eyes and after he spits, he derisively says, I assume you do good as a from the Mappamundi Institute.
Oh, yes, of course we are. You're right, good sir. You seem quite injured there.
Yeah, try these mushrooms. They'll help clear the pain.
We've just helped older women with a head injury too. There's quite a lot of people hurt in these woods.
Well, he said, so he is, you know, he realizes he's got little opportunity but to tolerate your presence here. He kind of tries to push himself up on the rocks and you hear him grunting and he's evidently in some quite considerable pain. He kind of clutches at his side with his one, you know, his injured but, you know, but still usable arm. And he says, if you come here to find it, it's got, you know, it threw me off. It's, you know, the thing's yours now. Whatever it is you people do, the thing is yours now.
Can I give you a question? Pierre, was it, yes?
Yeah.
Once you are healed, do you intend to continue hunting this creature?
This one, this one's a dud, he says. There's nothing I can take back from this one that will do anyone any good.
All right. And a secondary one. Are you particularly, did you come here hunting on a noble cause because villagers were disappearing or merely for the trophy?
So he kind of bursts out into a sardonic, sarcastic laugh. And he says, you know as well as I do what I came here for. And it certainly wasn't for those idiot villagers.
Was it for the honey?
I'm glad I can keep my promise and help all who will not do harm to others. And since you're clearly, of course, incapable of doing half the moment, why not take the mushrooms? They're the only medicine we really have left after helping that elderly woman back there.
So this man is not an idiot. And he, as the mushrooms are proffered to him, he slaps them out of Matt's hand and says, he scoffs at you and says, well, what happened to do no harm, eh? Like you're the do-gooders, you're the protectors, you're the ones that look down on people like me. Imagine offering someone something that you know is going to hurt them.
Well, I'm no herbalist. I suppose, sir, I just couldn't tell.
My good sir, we will not be doing harm. The harm merely comes from the mushroom. Your choice of eating them is your own fault.
We are entitled to prevent harm. And as you know, the map on the Institute isn't about people, is it? We are do-gooders, tree-huggers. We very much are more concerned with nature than man.
How about deal?
So this, as Flower, so Pierre looks at Philip and recognizes someone who, at the very least, resembles him. You know, you're both wearing protective clothing, and so the notion of a deal certainly piques his curiosity. And says, "Well, what is it? What's your deal, Guardian?"
If we help you with this creature, and we all survive, will you come back and face justice?
There's no law against this, unfortunately. In fact, if he did indeed succeed in killing it, in some areas he'd be lauded as a hero.
And it's unnecessarily kill it.
He could always point us in the correct direction, I suppose. In return, we might actually tend his injuries.
So hearing this offer and realizing that he is, you know, he's going no further towards his quarry, Pierre says, "Throw me some bandages and get lost down into that dip over there. You'll see it." He said, "Believe me, you can't miss it." And you kind of hear him, you know, you hear him mumbling under his breath, you know, as if they were calling it the root and branch monster, and you know, kind of cursing his luck that someone as experienced as him should end up in this position.
You will die eventually. Your blood will feed the land you once took from, and that is all that can ever happen. Although I would hurry with those bandages. There are quite a few bears around.
So pushing himself up and propping himself up, he kind of pins his arm to his side and starts to kind of make a makeshift sling. It's clear that the arm that's hanging down by his side is broken, that he's fallen from some kind of great height. And so as he turns to walk away, he gives you one more sardonic look. And he says to you, "I bet you don't even know what it's actually called, do you?"
"Don't need to know and don't particularly care. I'm more interested in preserving the creature than its name. But if you want to tell us..."
We push him down the hill.
We probably saw the name first, then we push him down the hill.
Is it called a mother-in-law?
He's far enough away from you that pushing him down the hill... He's, you know, this is a man...
Don't kick him down the hill!
This is a man... This is a man that remains dangerous even in defeat. But he says to you... He says, those stupid villagers, they called it the root and branch monster. But he said it, some of them at least did know that it existed, or thought they knew that it existed. And he says, "We call it in the trade, we call it the Helix Carcoal." And he says, "You'll see why when you clap eyes on it."
All right, then, go stumble your way back to disgrace. And we'll actually hunt this thing down in your stead, I suppose, though for much better means.
So as he turns away, you hear him kind of laughing to himself as he kind of limps off into the distance. Satisfyingly for you, as you turn around, you do hear what sounds like Elodie shouting, and then you hear the sound of something hitting a human body, and Pierre crying out in pain, still definitely alive and walking, but you like to imagine that Elodie has thrown a rock at him, Just because you have sworn to do no harm doesn't mean that everyone has.
Emily, my good girl, aim for the arm. It's already broken. You'll hurt more.
All so, for the family jewels.
Only at this point, only one thing awaits you, and that is to crest over the top of the hill and finally encounter your target. So the journey phase comes to an end, and we stand on the precipice of the encounter phase.